The subject for today is the state for Jews or Jewish state. What is the state of Israel and what is the significance for us and for Judaism? And of course, we all concern with and pray for the safety of Jewish people in Israel, pray for the safety of the state of Israel. And there are lots of things, everyone has their pet peeves, and no one likes the government in Israel, no matter what the government is, right? There's not a person in Israel happy with the government. And some of the things, some of the negatives, not so bad, just the fact that no one respects your personal space there is because everyone's family. Everyone's family, that's where it is. I remember I was on a public phone in this army base, I forgot where it was. There was it was probably in the 90s. It was before everyone had cellular phone implants in Israel, and so there was this one public telephone on the base, and I was phoning my parents. It was winter. It was a small phone booth, looked something like a small Ottoman Empire torture chamber, and so I'm in the phone booth and phoning my parents. It was snowing outside. I was phoning my parents in Australia, and there's two guys trudging through the snow, and they both open up the door, they both come into the phone booth.
Oh, what?
To get out of the snow, right. Yeah. So I'm standing there, I said, Slicha, excuse me, it was like a reasonably large, but I said, Slicha, I'm on the phone. And one guy said, Bavakasha. go ahead. I said, Slicha prati. It's a private call. So the guy says, Nakatuvka. What does it say here? I said, telephone tziburi, which means public telephone. I say, I know it's a public phone, but I'm making a private call on a public phone.
Right.
He says, okay, so who's stopping you? I said, this is a private call. He says, what are you, a spy? So the reason there is this type of liberty taken is because of the fact that he looks at himself as family. And indeed, the casualness and the that overall feeling there, I think a lot of it is very positive, and it's because of that reason. We had our oldest son is now 16, but when he was a baby, he had colic. Basically, what that means is he cried continuously for about 6 months, unless he slept, which is a very minimum amount of time, right? So he was on the bus crying. Now, we didn't have a car, so we were on the buses. You cannot imagine how much advice we used to get about what to do with this child. Every single person on the bus. Right, give him a model, do this, put him upside down, shake him up, throw him in the air. That's unbelievable what people were telling us, right? Occasionally some people would throw him out, but I mean, basically crying. So, a lot of advice, but that's a very beautiful thing about it, is that feeling of family. What I would like to talk about, really, I think this may be, I don't know if it's equal or greater, but we always talk about the threat to survival of Israel from the Arabs, who, as we know, want to destroy Israel utterly. They do not want peace. That's clear. They do not just want the West Bank, so-called West Bank, Gaza Strip, Golan Heights. They want everything. They don't want there to be an Israel. That's blatantly clear to anyone who does not immediately swallow everything the CNN says. Right? I mean, I think, anyone who has ever read translations of Arabic broadcasts and translations of Arabic papers and statements of the newspapers and statements of Yasser Arafat and other dictators will clearly know that they want to destroy Israel. But I don't know if that's the greatest threat. There may be a worse threat, which is the internal. That is to say, that Israel, there's a book which has been recently written about the idea that Israel is what he calls the post-Zionist Israel, post-Zionist state of Israel. I forget the name of the book. It's by Jonathan. I don't know the book, but anyway, the book is about the post-Zionist state of Israel. He makes the claim that really Zionism has ended. It's over. There were these people who, for hundreds of years, 100 years or so, ardent Zionists who wanted to build a state of Israel, wanted to settle the land of Israel, believed it to be the national destiny and the right of the Jewish people. Tremendous self-sacrifice. These people had tremendous self-sacrifice in building the country, building the land, building the state. But that ideology, that idealism, and that passion doesn't seem to be there anymore in the vast majority of secular Israelis. It's to a great degree ended. You don't have that same passion. Ehud Barak, a highly decorated soldier, a person who fought for Israel, bravery with incredible sacrifice, was prepared. For him, Jerusalem really doesn't mean much, unfortunately. It does not mean much. He was prepared to give it up. Right? Of course, Yasser Arafat was not prepared to take 98%. He wanted everything. And so he started his present war against Israel again, restarted the war. But a leader of Israel should look at the Temple Mount and the Western Wall as insignificance, I think, is maybe even a worse problem than anything external. It was a story told, it was in the Israeli newspapers, of an Arab terrorist who was in Ramle prison. He was there on Passover. He was in prison over Passover. One of the Jewish guards is eating a pita. Now, this Arab used to work in a Jewish bakery, and he knew that Pesach was a time that they stopped baking, and people ate matzah. So he sees this Jewish guard eating a pita, leavened bread, and he says, "Hey, what are you doing eating pita? It's Pesach." And the guard says to him, "I don't keep Pesach." He says, "You don't keep Pesach?" "No, I don't care about Pesach. So I'm not religious." So the guy said, "Ah, we're going to win." That's what he said. "We're going to win." And he understood that a nation that doesn't have an appreciation, a pride, and a love for where it comes from is a nation that's in great danger. Great, great danger. Because it's only with internal strength and internal pride and internal sureness that we are correct, we are right, that we can actually succeed against these overwhelming numbers and the overwhelming hatred for Israel, which is really just incredible. The hatred is absolutely incredible. And so that's really part of what I want to talk about. From a spiritual point of view also, a question could be asked, why do we need a country at all? Why do we need a country? In other words, in the 19th century, there's a lot of debate about Zionism. The Reform movement initially rejected it totally. And their reasoning was that the focus of the Jewish people on a particular country and on a particular a Jewish state was problematic. They felt that it was not humanistic. They felt it was too ethnocentric, and they felt that it was not loyal to the country in which they lived. So, for instance, in the early Reform prayer books, you will not find any mention of return to Israel or Zion or Jerusalem or the Messiah or the Temple. It was expunged. It was only put back in the 60s, 1960s. But until that time, it was all expunged. And in a conference, there's a book called The Jew in the Modern World by Yehuda Reinhartz and Paul Mendes Flohr, printed by Oxford University Press. It's a documentary history of the modern Jewish world. And they have the minutes of the meetings of the early Reform temples, the Hamburg Temple and other temples. And in one of them, they are right that the reason they're against it is because they said, "We are Germans. Our loyalty is first to our fellow Germans and then to our fellow Jews. Our fatherland is Germany, not Israel, and for us, Berlin is Jerusalem." It's a terrible, terrible statement. But let's try to examine it, because is there not a kernel? I mean, isn't there something to their claim? Judaism is, after all, a way of life, a way of achieving closeness to God, closeness to our soul and to other people. So why should we be bothered with the country? I mean, Christianity doesn't have a country. Christianity is really 2 billion people. There's no country. What's a Christian country? What's their homeland? They don't have a homeland. They don't need one. You can have a religion without a homeland. Right? Why should a religion need a homeland? Why does a religion need a state? A state's got bureaucracy and an army and politics and economics and all types of garbage. And why do we need it? So that's a question, I think, which these early Reform thinkers grappled with. And unfortunately, they went in a direction which I think was rather tragic. But the question, I think, is a legitimate question. It's a legitimate question. What is it about? What's the state for? In other words, a person could make a pragmatic argument. Look, there's no one else that wants Jews. You know the story of the St. Louis, the ship the St. Louis, which was sent from Germany, which Hitler allowed to go out with those Jews on it, right? Actually, the gateway is dinner. anyone was there, Gateway's dinner, we had Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii speaking about this, and he pointed out that it was sent because Germany knew that no one really wanted Jews either. And the St. Louis went to England, and England said, no, we don't want you. And it was all these refugees, and it went to the United States, went to New York, was rejected, went to Miami, it was rejected, went to Cuba. Cuba saw that America didn't want these people, so Cuba said, forget it. It was sent back to Hamburg. They all were killed. All these Jews. No one wanted them. So an argument could be made, well, we need a state for pragmatic reasons, but it can't be. And that's why the Torah tells us, look at Nachmanides, in his listing of the commandments, he writes, we have been commanded to inherit the land that the Almighty One gave to our forefathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not to leave it in the hands of other nations and not to leave it desolate. Three things. To inherit the land means take possession, not to leave it in the hands of others, and number three, to build it up. So according to Nachmanides, this is a biblical commandment. And Maimonides, so it doesn't seem to be just a pragmatic consideration. We need a place of refuge, so we need a place called Israel. I don't think that makes sense. It also, I don't think it's true that it's merely a place which is, it's got to be more than that. I think it's got to be more than that. And it doesn't make sense to me that it's just a big refugee camp. In addition, Maimonides says in the Book of the Commandments, Commandment 153, we talked about yesterday in our Shabbos prayers, we sanctified or we blessed the coming new moon, the month of Shvat, right, month of Shvat. When we celebrated the month of Shvat, the 11th month of the Jewish calendar. And that sanctification of the new moon, really, that new moon, we're not sanctifying, it was actually sanctified when, anyone know when the new moon of Shvat coming up next Shabbos was sanctified? When was it declared to be the Rosh Chodesh, the new moon? Anyone know? We didn't do it in Shul. That was not us who was doing it. It was sanctified in about 350 CE by the Sanhedrin of Hillel the Second. Now, the Jewish court sanctified it. The only way you can sanctify a month in the Jewish calendar is if a Jewish court in the land of Israel duly appointed by a previous Sanhedrin sanctifies a month. And you can only have a month sanctified if there are still Jews living in Israel who are a continuation of that Sanhedrin. Is this clear? That means, let me read you what Maimonides says. If, God forbid, there were no Jews living in the land of Israel, something which is of course impossible, since we have been promised by God that he will never annul the signs of our nationhood. Maimonides adds, parenthetically, he says, I'm asking a theoretical question. He says, it is not possible that there'll be no Jews ever in Israel. There's a promise there'll always be Jews in Israel. Why? He says, because God promised that he would never annul the signs of our nationhood. Lo yivatel otop ha'uma, the signs of our nationhood. So, just parenthetically, Maimonides seems to say that the fact that we have a land and there are Jews there, what is that? What is that? Is it pragmatic? Is it a refugee thing? It's a sign of our nationhood. Okay, and he goes on. He says, therefore, there will always be a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. But he says, if theoretically there be no Jews in Israel, listen to what he says, then our calculations of the new moon and our calendar would become null and void. Null and void. We would not be able to celebrate anything in the Jewish calendar except for Shabbat. Shabbat doesn't need a calendar. It's every 7 days. It's easy. But Passover, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Rosh Chodesh, all the fast days, Purim, Chanukah, nothing. End of story. Couldn't do it. So what we see from Maimonides from Nachmanides is that there's something to the Jewish presence in Israel more than just a refuge. There is some positive spiritual component to it. There is some intrinsic reason for it. What is the reason? So we find the reason, a few ideas. First of all, Isaiah. Yeshayahu ben Amoz, Isaiah prophesied, chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. He said the following. It will be in the end of days that the mountain of God will be secure and at the head of all mountains and raised above all hills, and all nations will stream towards it. V'naharu elav kol hagoyim. And many nations will go and say, let us go and ascend to the mountain of God, to the house of Jacob, and we will be instructed in his ways, and we will walk in his path. Very beautiful verse. What's the context? He's talking about what will happen in the messianic times. That the destiny of Israel and Jerusalem is that nations will stream towards Israel and say to the Jewish people, teach us the Torah. For, and then he continues, Kimitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Mirushalayim. Everyone's familiar with that word? Kimitzion Teitzei Torah. That one, right? From Zion shall come forth the Torah, the word of God, from Jerusalem. Most people are not aware that the context of that verse is, who shall the word of Torah come to from Jerusalem? Who's it referring to? That's right, to the whole world. The whole world, not just the Jews. Kimitzion Teitzei Torah, Zion shall come forth the Torah and the word of God from Jerusalem, refers to the word of God coming to everyone, the whole world. So Jerusalem and Israel is there for one reason, according to Isaiah, as a place, a beacon, a place which will spread the word of God. Very, very interesting. To the whole world, to the whole planet. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says, this is really why we need a country. He says the land was destined and dedicated to be a place that would teach the entire world the path of righteousness. The land was prepared for the tribes of Israel from the time of the division of languages. As it states, when God gave nations their heritage and split up the peoples, he set borders of nations for the sake of Israel's descendants. He says Abraham was not ready to cling to God and to make a covenant with God until he was in the land of Israel. And he says, the purpose of the Jews in Israel is to have an entire country where it runs according to the word of God and divine command. The agricultural system follows the rhythm of the sabbatical year cycle. The people give their tithes to the priests and to the poor and to the needy. The agricultural system goes in 7-year cycles, and in the 7th year there is a rest to the land. The country, the justice system, is based on the Torah. You have a Sanhedrin of 71 elders, and you have a Sanhedrin of 23 judges, and you have Sanhedrins all over the place of 3 judges. The army runs according to Jewish law. The whole country is a country which is a showcase for what Judaism is about. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says you've got to have a country for that. You can't just... Jews who are living anywhere else in the world, is there any system which runs totally according to Jewish law? Of course I can be a good Jew and live in the American system. In fact, it's the best system, the democratic system, is a wonderful system for Jews to live in. I'm not criticizing it. But is it, can people look at it and say, this is how the world should be? No. Right? The only way you can have that is if the Jewish people build their own country based on Jewish values, build their own army based on Jewish values, build their own court system based on Jewish values, and then that will be the working model of what the ideal world shall look like. That's why we need a state. That's why we need a country. It's not just a refugee place. It's not just a ghetto. It's not the 51st state of America. Where is the 52? You're up to, I don't know what you're up to. It's not my country. Anyway, I pay taxes here, but I can't vote. So, but what is it? It's the model of what life should be like. I would say that even though the state of Israel today is a secular country, officially, it's a country which has been ruled by WASPs for most of its history, white Ashkenazi socialist paratroopers, nevertheless, it's a country which has exhibited Jewish values in many different ways. Take, for example, Golda Meir's statement. She once said, and you'll never ever hear this from an Arab leader. Never, guaranteed, will you hear this statement or anything like this from an Arab leader. Golda Meir said, I could forgive the Arabs for killing our children. I could never forgive them if they would make our children into killers. Isn't that an incredible statement? Would you ever hear that from Saddam Hussein? You think you'd hear that from Assad? In Syria, will you hear that from Hussein in Jordan? Will you hear that from Mubarak, from Yasser Arafat? You're not going to hear this from anyone else. You won't hear this from Colin Powell either, for that matter. Right? This is a very Jewish sentiment. The idea that, Golda Meir was not a pacifist. We have to have an army. We believe in self-defense. The Torah says, one who comes to kill you, get up and kill him first. You're allowed to self-defense. Preemptive strike is legitimate. You're allowed to do that. You're obligated to do that. We don't believe in pacifism and of lying there and saying, yes, please do whatever you want to me. No. But on the other hand, do we glorify it? Do we glorify war? No. In the state of Israel, I think this is one of the most amazing and beautiful statements from a leader anywhere in the world, ever. Not only that, you look, you go to Israel, most of the country has served in the army at some point. Yeah, people are very highly decorated soldiers. Do you see people walking around with chests covered with medals? You ever see this in Israel? You go to West Point, you go to any South American country, what do you see? How do these generals look? They're covered head to toe with medals. They shine like the light of a thousand suns. They have braid, they have campaign medals, they have clusters, they have oak leaves, they have this, they have that. It's unbelievable. They're like a walking jewelry store. You go to Israel, right, you see some guy, right, even if he's in his dress uniform, which is a not very well ironed khaki uniform, he's usually got like falafels, some wings, and that's about it. Not much else. Really not much else. I saw a picture in the Army magazine once, Ehud Barak, standing next to an Argentinian general who was visiting. Ehud Barak has got a row of campaign badges, paratrooper wings, a couple of round things that are called falafels, right? And the Argentinian general was literally bulletproof. He had so many medals. He was covered with medals. It was and keep in mind that they lost the Falklands. So here you go. Right? That, I think, is a very Jewish value. Very Jewish value. If the world was capable, and I don't think they are, but if the world was capable of looking at Israel and looking at the situation that we're in objectively, they would be very impressed. If they would see the conduct of the Israeli army versus the conduct of any army in the world, including the American army, if they would see the amount of civilian casualties that are caused by other armies doing the same as Israel needs to do versus what Israel has done, I think they'd be very impressed. Have you heard of Israel dropping a daisy cutter bomb on Ramallah? Has it happened? You know what a daisy cutter bomb is? It's a bomb that America has used in Afghanistan. It destroys an entire city block in one shot. Huh? Where? In Afghanistan, that's right. The United States, say we, I mean Israel, right? But the United States has dropped hundreds of them in Afghanistan, right? I mean, they're not exactly targeted killings. You drop a bomb which will wipe out a city block, right, because there are a couple of Al-Qaeda guys in the block. How many people are you going to kill together with that? Hundreds, right? But America's not going to tolerate lots of Marine casualties. They're not going to send their boys in house-to-house fighting. They'll drop some bombs. They'll have the F-16s. They'll drop a bomb. They'll have laser-guided munitions. Not a problem. Piece of cake. What does Israel do? Israel goes into Jenin and we lost... What was it? 23 boys there. Right? 23 of our brothers there. Why? Because Israel is not prepared to drop a daisy cutter bomb on Jenin. So instead, we have soldiers go in house to house and we incur casualties. And let me ask you, do you think one Israeli weapon would be fired if we had no suicide bombers or terrorism?
No.
Of course not. I don't believe that it would be one Israeli soldier who would be pulling a weapon, the trigger of his gun, if we wouldn't have all this terrorism. Do you think, though, that if the state of Israel existed, and we did not have any settlements, and we did not have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights, that we would have Arabs firing weapons at us?
Yes.
This is not a theoretical question. This happened. From 1948 to 1967, did we have the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights? No. Did we have terrorism?
Yeah.
Do we have Jewish casualties?
Yeah.
Do we have wars? Yes. So there's the answer to your question. It's not a question, it's not theory. I can look back in history. When there were no settlements, we had Arabs attacking us. There are settlements, Arabs attacking us. But there's no question that Israel is an opportunity for the display of Jewish values. The army is kosher. You know that's kosher. They keep kosher. The whole army keeps kosher. At least officially it does. I can't guarantee that every single army base is kosher, but officially it keeps kosher. All the food that comes in is kosher. The milk and meat are cooked separately. Every army kitchen has got a separate area for milk and meat. No chametz on Pesach. The state of Israel, 98% of the houses have got mezuzahs on the door. Now, I'm not saying Israel is far from perfect. And I said beforehand that we have a tremendous, tremendous battle now. There's a problem. There are a lot of Israelis who have lost all ideology in terms of Zionism. And they have also lost all their Jewish pride. They don't feel a connection to history. Part of this is the education system. My wife did her master's at the Hebrew University. One of the courses she took involved observations in Israeli schools. So I have to ask her, I think I'm getting this accurate. She went to an Israeli school for gifted children, and she was observing. They were teaching the story of Passover. This was probably in 80-something, 86. I think she was there, 86. The teacher taught the story of the Exodus. We just read it yesterday. Moses goes out and kills the Egyptian. How did this teacher teach it? Moses killed the bourgeoisie Egyptian overseer who was beating the proletariat worker. So Moses was a Marxist.
No.
I don't believe that. It's okay. The teacher said that. Basically, that no mention of God, no mention of idolatry, no mention of intervention of God. It's a class struggle. You've got the Egyptian middle class, the Egyptian bourgeoisie, oppressing the Jewish workers. This is before there were labor unions, right? So Moses killed him. Part of the dialectic class struggle, etc. I mean, could it be expected that a child who grew up with that education will come along and say, the Torah promises is like the Torah? The Torah? So unfortunately, we have a tremendous, and I think it's a real problem. But in Jewish tradition, we believe that we need a state, we need a country. The whole infrastructure has to be like. Let me read to you the words of Rabbi Samson and Raphael Hirsch. In the Parsha last week, not this Shabbos that we read yesterday, but last week, the last section of Genesis, Jacob gives a blessing to his sons. There, he describes the Jewish people as a kahal amim. You shall become a kahal. What does kahal amim mean? Kahal, assembly, amim, of nations. So the Jewish people are told to become an assembly of nations. The United Nations, God forbid we should become the United Nations, right? But no semblance to the United Nations is intended here, right? So the Jewish people are told that we'll become kahal goyim, an assembly of nations. What does it mean to be an assembly of nations? I would say the assembly of nations, this is what Refers says. Because another question could be asked. He says, why are we divided into tribes? Right? Why should the Jews be divided into 12 tribes? Why don't I have just Jews? Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, Reuven, Shimon, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Binyan, Yosef. What for? Have one people. So he says the following. Each tribe, we note, have very unique characteristics. And he says, the nation is to represent agriculture as well as commerce, militarism as well as culture and learning. The Jewish people will be a nation of farmers, businessmen, soldiers, and scientists, thereby as a model nation to factually establish the truth that the one great personal and calling which God revealed in his Torah is not dependent on any particular kind of character trait or calling, but that the whole of mankind, in all its shades of diversity, can equally find its calling in the one common spiritual and moral mission and outlook in life. Refers to saying the Jewish people are meant to represent the possibility that any human being on this planet, whether he be an aggressive military type, whether he be a businessman, whether she be artistic, or whether she be an accountant, or whether he is a farmer, or she is a shopkeeper, or whatever it is, it doesn't matter what your particular character is, everything can be directed towards becoming a moral and good person, having a relationship with God. So God created the Jewish people as a diversity within that unity. We were the original rainbow coalition. That is, that within the Jewish people there's a rainbow of nations. Every single one of the tribes was a very unique and different characteristic. And that was designed to show. So how can each one show that lesson if they don't have a state? Obviously not. To have a state, to have a commonwealth, to have a Jewish country which is run by according to Judaism. So you have an army which you say, well, here is a person who is indeed an exemplary Jew. You know, I was thinking, I was in Israel a couple of months ago, and I'm sure I've mentioned this, but Israel a couple of months ago, I had the privilege of meeting a number of great personalities. One of them was Ephraim Eitam. Ephraim Eitam at the time was Minister of Infrastructure of the State of Israel. The Minister of Infrastructure of the State of Israel, he was in the security cabinet of the government. So I had a two-hour meeting with him. He was brought up on Kibbutz Ein Gev, which is a left-wing socialist kibbutz on the banks of the Kinneret. At the age of 27, when he went into the army, he went into the naval commandos, Commando Yami, who's a naval commando. Later on, he was in the Sayeret Matkal. That means he was at Entebbe with Elizabeth Taylor and everyone, right? So he was there. And he was also, later on, became commander of all Israeli special forces and attained the rank of general in the Israeli army. At the age of 27, he became religious, became observant. He went to Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva and he got smicha, ordination, from there. So he has a degree in politics, international relations and mathematics from Haifa University. He's a minister in the Israeli government, he's an ordained rabbi, and he is the most dangerous person I've ever met. Right? Physically, just, you know, my hand was shaking for hours after he shook my hand. Right? But, so, you know, I don't agree with a lot of his politics. He's a lousy politician because he usually says what he thinks. So that's not very smart. Right? So, but anyway, not a good politician. It was the Abba Iban, who just recently passed away, one of the greatest Israeli diplomats to ever live, I think the greatest. He once said, the art of diplomacy is the art of saying nice doggy, while you're looking for a stick. So, he, in any case, I'm looking at Ephraim Aidan, I say, you know, this is a little bit what it's about, right? Because here is a person who is a soldier through and through, a military man par excellence, and nevertheless, he's a man of faith. He's a man who brings out Jewish ideals in what he does. And so while I may disagree with much of his politics, but I look at him and I say, this is why we have a state. We have a state so we can have a person like that who, yeah, he's a special forces commander who, instead of having large tattoos on his biceps, has tefillin on. Instead of walking around with a shaved skull with a crossbones on it or something like that, he's got a large knitted yarmulke there, right? It's a very beautiful thing. It's a very different thing than what could be. So that's how Rav Hirsch looks at it. Rav Hirsch looks at the diversity of nations within the Jewish people, of the tribes, and that has to be expressed within the state. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg writes, it is impossible for Judaism to be confined within the religious rituals of the synagogue. It strives to encompass all areas of life and to rule over all of them absolutely. Agriculture, art, society, art, science, and politics, all of them are stamped with the seal of Judaism. The prophets, the authors of the Mishnah, the authors of the Talmud were not just holy Nazarites. They were heroes of human life, men of action, full of the joy of life and all its activities. All the prophets were married, they had families. All the great rabbis of the Talmud, with one exception out of the thousands of rabbis, were married. I'm always reminded of a great Gemara, which I always used to get a kick out of. It's the Gemara is discussing, on Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, you're not supposed to bathe for pleasure. You're not supposed to wash for pleasure. You can wash for minimum hygiene purposes, right? Whatever you need, minimum hygiene. But not for pleasure. Right? So the Gemara is talking about, are you allowed to wash your hands to feed a child? That's legitimate. So Thomas says, yeah, it is legitimate. So authentic hygiene purpose, right? And certainly not a pleasure, generally, feeding the child, right? So usually, you know. Right, of course, later on you have to take a shower after, depending on the kid. I used to throw cereal. My parents told me I used to throw a lot of food. My father cured me of that. He once put a bowl of porridge on my head. Right, and basically that I never threw food again, amazingly enough. Right? So anyway, until I got to high school, actually, but that was. But it brings an example of Shammai. Shammai, the great sage, Shammai, people have heard of Shammai, Hillel and Shammai. So he says, Shammai, one of the students says, I saw Shammai Hazakain, the elder Shammai, head of the Jewish Supreme Court, feeding his child before synagogue on Yom Kippur morning. Isn't that a beautiful image? Right, what is Shammai, the head of the Sanhedrin, the greatest, one of the greatest rabbis of the Jewish people to have ever lived, on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur morning, before shul? Have some more farina, please. Eat your oatmeal, please, right? That's what he's doing. And I saw him wash his hand beforehand. Isn't that great? That, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg says, is what Judaism is about. Judaism is not meant to be confined in the synagogue to a Nazarite, to a temple, to anything like that. It's supposed to spread its influence over every area of life. And of course, isn't that what a state is about? So one of the great proponents of this concept in our modern times was Rav Avram Yitzhak HaKohen Cook. In one of his books called Orot, in the first chapter, he writes that the secular Zionists have made a tremendous mistake, he says. They have in some way tried to separate nationalism from Judaism as if they're two separate things. As if there is a national entity of the Jewish people without Judaism. He says, of course, others have made the mistake that they say there's a Judaism without the national entity. He says, no, they're intertwined together. He says there's a great mistake amongst those who do not understand the uniqueness of the Jewish nation. In their imaginations, they desire to equate this divine unity of a people to the feelings of unity and nationalism of all the families of nations. From this comes a desire to separate the national ideal from the religious ideal and to make them into two separate entities. He says both these entities would be a falsehood. He says because all the aspects of thought and idealism that we find in the Jewish people, national and religious, are one inseparable entity. The combination of these ideals makes up the complete picture of the Jewish people. The complete picture, because if you wanted to define the Jews, we're not a religion, we're not a nation, we're both. We're a nation because we have a common religion, but we're not just a religion, we're also a nation. And a nation, the natural situation, state with a small s of a nation, is to have a state with a big S. That's what it's about. And so, when we look at the whole idea of the state of Israel, we would have to say that it's not a state for Jews. It's supposed to be a Jewish state. A Jewish state. That means that's why for us it's so important. Now, I say for us, I suppose, the Jews who identify strongly with Judaism. And I lived in Israel 16 years. For me, it was the idea that the day of rest, the national day of rest in Israel, is Shabbat. Shabbat. That's not because I want to coerce. I don't think it's right to coerce people to keep Shabbat. But if every nation is going to have a day of rest. And in Christian countries like the United States, it's Sunday, and therefore the mall closer to us off the Garden State Parkway is closed on Sundays because of the blue laws. Then I think Israel, the Jewish character, the state of Israel, requires the day of rest be Saturday, Shabbat. Granted, for purposes of the stock markets and financial trade, maybe it'd be better to have it on Sunday. I don't know. But that's not what it's about, the Jewish character of the state of Israel. That the offices of the Israeli government are officially kosher. I don't care. The member of parliament might bring white meat into his office, right? Basar lavan, as they call it in Israel. Right? He may bring this into his office and eat stuff. That's not my concern. My concern is that the government's officially offices should be kosher. And there should be a mezuzah on the door here. That's not because I want to coerce people into keeping Judaism. I don't think it's right. I think it's negative to do that. I don't think the law is there to coerce people. That's not what it's for. But what I do believe is that the state of Israel is going to have a Jewish character. And I don't believe that it's got really, in terms of its whole raison d'etre, its reason for existence is as a Jewish state. Not just a state in which Jews can be comfortable and live, because there are other places we can be comfortable and live. There are democracies. We can live fine in America and Australia and New Zealand and Canada and England. Not a problem. Right? But Israel is a place where we can look at it and we can say, in December, or around the winter of the year, you go through a mall in Jerusalem, you know what you hear? Al hanisim ve'alapur kamim ma'osu yeshuati. That's going to be going over and over again in your head, not jingle bells. Right? That is what it's meant to be about. When you come out after Sukkot, right? Or Sukkot, you're going to the supermarket. I mean, I remember getting this, right? So you've got sets of Lulav Etrog Hadassim and Aravot, right, with a kosher certification, Rav Kook in Rechavot, right? I remember getting some for the kids from the local Super Soul supermarket. I pick up some from the rack, special Lulavim and Esroyim, right? And I take it to the checkout counter, got the barcode, she goes, what do you mean? She goes, don't throw it! She goes, how they do it, like they dip and then throw. You don't want to throw the Lulav. You know what a Lulav is, right? The palm frond we use for Sukkot. That's a get out of the supermarket. And the local supermarket lights Hanukkah candles in Hanukkah. and they gave out candies to whatever kids were there, right? They gave out little chocolates to the kids, whoever was there for the candle lighting, and Adam and Gilla reading in the supermarket, right? And I know that the Adam and Gilla reading at the Super Soul in Haranoth, that's not an unusual thing in Israel. It's not a bizarre thing, right? It's actually, you know, the flow, the ebb and flow of the calendar. The way I feel about the calendar and the way I feel about seasons, what are my associations? What are my children's associations? Right, so outside of Israel, granted, I live a full Jewish life, but I live a Jewish life within an environment which is Christian or secular, you know, or either one, right, or both, right? But that's the environment in which we live. So therefore, you can't but help that the associations in our minds of the seasons and the calendars and anything else is that's what it is. It's not Judaism. And the specials and the stores and whatever it happens to be, it's all something which is a little bit, so I would say that also for the full Jewish life, the state and a state of Israel, a commonwealth of Israel with a Jewish nation, it doesn't even if it's not a fully religious state, but even that it has a Jewish character as it does today, that is also essential, I think, for the Jewish people. So therefore. And I think that the modern-day state of Israel has got to be a continuation of what it was. For instance, David Ben-Gurion, in his address to the Knesset, said the following. The state of Israel is not a Jewish state merely because the majority of its inhabitants are Jewish. It is a state for all the Jews, wherever they may be, and for every Jew who so desires. On the 14th of May 1948, a new state was not founded ex nihilo, something from nothing. Rather, the crown was restored to its pristine splendor 1,813 years ago after the independence of Israel was destroyed during the days of Bar Kokhba and Rabbi Akiva. He said this is a continuation. It's not a new thing that's something out of nothing. It's something from something. Right? And it's a continuation. The language, the language of Hebrew. Let me read to you what David Ben-Gurion said. This is from the Jewish Frontier Anthology, published in 1949. May I be permitted to say that a Jew who can name all the plants in Israel in Hebrew, or call all the parts of a tractor or some other complicated machine by their correct designations, possesses one qualification for useful service in the state of Israel. But who amongst us could fail to see in this not merely a technical or utilitarian, but a cultural value as well? But, he says, if he does not know to their deepest meaning, and in their context of spiritual tension, such Hebrew expressions as mitzvah, aveirah, commandment, sin, geulah, redemption, tikkun, tuma, impurity, tara, purity, yira, fear, ava, love, tzedakah, charity, chesed, kindness, mesirut nefesh, self-sacrifice, kiddush Hashem, sanctification of the name of God, dveikut, clinging to God, teshuvah, repentance. He says if he doesn't know these words, he cannot carry part in the choir that gives voice to what I have called the Jewish melody. Even so-called secular Jewish education in the state of Israel, if it is not to be drained of those powers that build the Jewish personality, must be nourished from sources which are regarded as religious. That's a beautiful statement by Ben-Gurion. Unfortunately, it was not followed. Unfortunately, so much of the education system is focused on how many parts of a tractor can you name in Hebrew? Can you order something at McDonald's in Hebrew? Can you? That's what it's focused on, right? But the focus on what really the word mitzvah means, tahara, kiddush Hashem, that's lost, unfortunately, and has not been emphasized nearly enough in the modern-day state of Israel. So obviously, in our present conflict, we find Israel in tremendous danger. There's got to be two strategies. There's got to be an external strategy and an internal strategy. The external strategy is military and political. I'm not a military or political expert, right? But obviously from a military strategy, the self-defense, the killing of those who would seek to kill us, clearly military strategy. Politics, they have to work on diplomacy and international relations and et cetera, et cetera. That's the external. But there's an internal struggle which is just as important, if not more important. The people in Israel start to understand that they've got to build, we've got to build ourselves internally from the inside out. we can't expect that people will fight for the state of Israel if they have no ideological basis for it. We can't expect that people continue to live in Israel, in a country where it's all beset with so many problems, if they can go to America and live an easy life. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of Yerida, a lot of people who've moved, and, you know, Los Angeles, big Jewish community, big Israeli community, bigger than Tel Aviv, no? I'm not sure. All right, but it's a problem. It's a problem. And part of that problem is there's not enough connection to our ancient Jewish roots. The early Zionists, even those who were secular, like David Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir, and all these, they nevertheless had an appreciation of the Torah, an appreciation of Jewish history, an appreciation of our heritage. They didn't necessarily believe it all. They didn't necessarily practice it all, but there was a strong, deep connection and respect for that. And I remember reading that when the Yemenite Jews came from Yemen to Israel, one of the advisors of Ben-Gurion said to him, "Look at this, incredible. It's a fulfillment of the words of Theodor Herzl and Max Nordau, two great Zionist philosophers." And Ben-Gurion said, "No, it's not." He said, "The Yemenite Jews never heard of Herzl or Nordau." He said, "This is a fulfillment of Isaiah and Ezekiel." He said, "Because they've been waiting for 2,000 years, 2,500 years, for the words of Isaiah and Ezekiel that God will bring the Jews back to Israel. That's what it's a fulfillment of." He understood that we are a continuation of what was. We're not a new thing. And as the more we understand that, the stronger the state of Israel will be. I remember having a poster in my bedroom when I was a kid from the Jewish agency. And the poster was a conical flask from a lab, which was inside a old ancient Israelite pottery vessel, right, which was broken. So you can see the conical flask inside this ancient pottery vessel from Israel. And underneath the poster it says, "Our future is where our past is." And it's so true, so true, right, that the future of the Jewish people requires that we have a respect and a connection to the past and to what has actually brought the state of Israel into existence ultimately, which was this belief in the Torah and was the passion of the Jewish people for nationhood, for Israel, and for the state. So, again, what can we do about this? Obviously, we can have our prayers, and our prayers will certainly help, and obviously our visiting Israel is certainly something which is important that will help, and our financial help for Israel, and our lobbying politically, and every area that we can help Israel, certainly all of it contributes and all of it is necessary and all of it is part of our obligation of efforts for our brothers and sisters. By far, though, the greatest contribution can be that if we can help somehow strengthen the educational system in Israel in ways that will bring more Torah to the Jewish people, more of a pride and a connection to our roots, to the Jewish people. There's no question that's the ultimate. We're going to save us. We're not going to, you know, unfortunately, the way it works is that yes, you have to have an army, but the army has got to have an internal engine of idealism, an internal engine of passion, and an internal engine of connection to God and to the Torah to be able to win and to go up against the tremendous odds that we are. So that's our prayer, that through us learning Torah, helping Israel everywhere we can, visiting Israel, making Aliyah, right, but helping all those efforts in Israel, then hopefully we will merit to see peace and security for our brothers and sisters in Israel, all around the world, and the redemption very speedily in our days. Thank you very much. And I'll be happy to take questions. Yeah.
I was looking on the Ellis Island website, the searcher, my grandmother. I wanted to find my grandmother and grandfather. And lo and behold, I found my grandmother, 8 months old, arrived on a ship from Russia. So in the category, in the find, it said Russian Hebrew. And I said, wait, this looks very odd, because if you look on the rest of the passenger list, if you're from Russia, it just said Russia. It didn't say Russian Protestant, Russian Catholic, but if you were Hebrew, you were Mark. So then I did a further search, just random search, and it turned out the same thing. If you were from Italy and you were Jewish, you were Italian Hebrew. So then I decided, well, let's go and see someone emigrated to Ellis Island from Israel, or what they call Palestine, and sure enough, all it would say was Hebrew. So my point, what I was going to ask you was, there must have been world support for Israel to come about in the first place, because in other words, here is this. They were treating, if you looked at the possibilities of people coming to this country, Hebrew was actually treated as a nationality on this website.
Sure.
So and made me think that there must have been tremendous world view, and probably still, there probably still, I mean, not just an isolated group who thinks that Israel should be.
Oh, no, no, no. We have a lot of support. We did have a lot of support then. Of course, there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of debate about it, but as we know, eventually the United Nations resolution, there was a majority of people that voted for the establishment of the State of Israel, majority of countries. And I think there was a lot of strong public sentiment in many places towards the establishment of the State of Israel. But we did have that support, and people have, you know, deep down, your average, I think the average non-Jew probably recognizes, of course, there's a nation of Israel and it's connected to the Jewish people. There's a lot of bamboozling by the media, a lot of confusion, and so that has created a lot of, you know, ambivalence towards it. But you're right. It's not, we're not isolated as We have friends, and we have a lot of people who recognise what I've been saying as well, even from outside the Jewish people. One example would be Senator Inouye, who spoke at the Gateways Dinner, a very strong, strong friend of Israel and of Jewish education in every single way. Yeah.
I mean, there are many reasons. Arab oil, of course, is very important. But what do you think is something even more important that is motivating the nations of the world, especially supposedly the our allies and friends in Europe, which they are not, to be so, I don't even want to use the word harsh, but so totally biased against Israel and the Jews in their current political stance?
I think there's many reasons. I think, you know, one reason is oil, as you mentioned, and that's a very, very important reason. I can't imagine, like European democratic nations supporting totalitarian dictatorships, which are like these feudal medieval monarchies in Saudi Arabia, the only family business to have a seat in the United Nations. You know, a place where they behead people, cut off people's hands, you're not allowed to celebrate any other religion aside from Islam. It is unbelievable they support these countries. Right? So oil, I think, France is not a question, they've always been anti-Semites. But a question of oil is very, very central to that. Secondly, these countries are scared, they have large Muslim populations. So, you know, when something goes against the Jews, do we tend to riot and kill people? When something goes against the Muslims, they tend to riot and kill people? Yeah. Nigeria, someone made a comment about Muhammad wanting to would maybe choose a wife from this world. 200 people were killed as a result of Muslim riots. Didn't get much press. Can you imagine, you know, 200 Muslims were killed in Israel because someone made a comment about Moses? You know that would be in the newspapers? Do you know what the condemnation would be? But Nigeria, it's a normal thing, nobody did it. Part of it's racism, because it wasn't white people being killed, it was blacks, so there's some racism there as well. But it's also because it wasn't Jews doing it, Muslims expected they do that type of stuff. So, there's a certain amount of fear. Number three, there's a certain amount of fear of the State of Israel. What's their fear of Israel? Not military fear, but what people recognize, deep down, I think they recognize that Israel, the revival of a Jewish country, a Jewish state, is indicative of a redemption. So there's a little, at the back of their mind, hold on, the Jews are back in Israel, they haven't accepted Jesus, they haven't accepted Muhammad, they're back in Israel, there's a strong Jewish country. What if the Jews are right? What if the Jews are right? What if we've been wrong about all this stuff? Right? It's a little frightening, right? And the fact that the Jewish people are back in Israel is type like, for them, it's like a person walking along the street, walking on the beach, and finding fresh dinosaur footprints in the sand. Oh, hold on. They're meant to be extinct. Why is there a Velociraptor footprint right here in the sand in Costa Rica? They're meant to be extinct. If I see a fossilized dinosaur footprint, no fear, no, I'm not scared of that. I can see a gigantic dinosaur fossil in the museum, doesn't bother me in the least. But if I would see a fresh, three-toed, big footprint in my backyard, I'd be scared. So when they see the State of Israel, they're seeing something that they thought was supposed to be extinct and dormant. We thought we got rid of you guys. Right, and now we're back. Now we're back. And now, so there's a little bit of a fear of maybe we are right. Maybe we are right. So that may be part of it as well. Okay, thank you very much. And I believe lunch has been served now.